Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Yeah, man, that's right. It's Monday and we are answering listener questions this week. We've got a bunch of great ones, including one about Roth IRA conversion, whether now is a good time to do that. We've got a question about paying down debt or, you know, maybe she should invest that money instead. We'll see. And then we've got a question too about money to set aside for home repairs, specifically for a rental property. We're going to get to all those plus two more within this episode. But first, man, let's talk about some investing.
Yeah, before we get to all the questions, I'm excited to get to them. I wanted to talk about micro investing apps. And we talked about those a long time ago, back in episode 29.
But, nice.
Yeah, but I feel like some of the things that we talked about in that episode actually have come to pass right now in kind of how a lot of young people specifically are handling investing inside of micro investing apps. And I've just seen a lot of news about poor judgment in regards to what they're investing in. I think we talked about this just a little bit last week when we were talking about investing in a volatile market. But I think micro investing apps in particular make people more prone to trade more frequently. And so if you're using an app like Robinhood or M1, you know, we like both of them. They've done a really good job at lowering the cost and making it easier for investors to get on board to start investing. But at the same time, I think a lot of young people just feel the need to trade more frequently and to trade when they don't need to. And it actually can lessen your returns over time. It can create a lot more stress. It can create an environment for poor investing. So yeah, I mean, that's something that we did talk about back in episode 29, that micro investing apps, they have all these great tools at your disposal. But then if you use them too much, it turns out to be a really bad idea.
It's like they make it too easy to trade.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
The interface is so slick. I just want to hop on there and like spend some money or make some sales, whatever. Well, specifically too, some of the bigger online brokerages as well. End of last year, they started charging $0 for commissions, which means that you could buy and sell stocks for free. Before that, it was like, what, $5 or $6, depending on who you're with.
Yeah, and Robinhood really, really accelerated that change.
Yes.
They kind of started it.
Yes, exactly. And so folks got used to that. And so now pretty much everyone is doing that. And the downside, though, like you said, when it's so easy and when it doesn't cost you any money and when these apps look so good on your phone, you kind of want to dive in there and see what's going on with the market, you're going to be more likely to sell. You're going to be more likely to make speculative moves, like short-term moves, which goes against everything that we would recommend.
Yeah, the day trading kind of mindset. It just becomes a lot easier to become kind of enthralled and have that sort of mindset when it comes to investing. We're completely not about that. We're about investing for the long haul. We're about simple investing. And so, yeah, I just wanted to caution people as I'm seeing more and more stories pop up about young people investing in a speculative way. By the way, I'm saying young people like we're really old or something like that.
Like millennials, like our generation.
Our generation.
Yeah.
Exactly. I hate seeing that because like we've talked about again and again, investing for the long haul, investing simply, low cost index funds in particular, and target date retirement funds. Those are going to be the best way to invest. And I love some of these new apps. We talk about M1. It's a fantastic app. They do a really good job. But if you're using it to do speculative or frequent trades, that is not a good idea. That's not a good use of a good app.
Yeah. And something else too is, you know, with the lockdown and with so many folks working from home, folks who are used to maybe like checking their accounts like during lunch, well, you can check it whenever you want. And so I think a lot of folks who might be sitting at home, you know, working on their laptop, sitting on the couch, they've got their, you know, E-Trade, TD Ameritrade accounts open off to the side. And they're watching the market thinking, oh, is now a good time to buy? Is now a good time to sell? I don't know. Folks are trying to time the market.
Obsessing a little too much.
Way too much. And, you know, we touched on this a little bit last week. I personally, you know, I kind of shared my long kind of story about about how I go about making purchases. I think it's totally fine to take advantage of dips if you're going to purchase and hang on to that for the long haul. But that is not how a lot of folks are approaching the market right now. One of those companies that I mentioned, they have seen the number of daily trades skyrocket since they started offering those trades commission-free. They said they used to have 1 million daily trades at the end of last year. And at this point now, they're seeing 3 million trades every single day. So,
yeah. So I guess there is a downside to free.
Yeah, exactly. It's increased threefold. So that's a bummer to see. Like you said, we don't like seeing that. That is not what we recommend. We want folks to buy low-cost index funds and hang on to them forever. And we've always been able to do that with Vanguard, with Fidelity. You log into your accounts there, buy those funds, and you're set.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not necessarily the micro investing app's fault. Some of those micro investing apps are great. They do a really good job. It's our behavior.
It's what it leads us to do.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so Matt, let's get on to the beer that we're having on the show today. We're drinking Dankbot by Insight Brewing. Big thanks to our listener, Joe, for sending this one our way. And we'll give our thoughts on this beer at the end of the episode. But for now, on to the subject at hand. We're taking listener questions. And for folks that want to send us their voice question for consideration to be on a future episode, we'd love to hear it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there for you to see how to record your voice question, send it on over to us, and hopefully we can take it on an upcoming episode.
And man, I wanted to mention real quick that if you had a guess, how many listener questions have we answered on our podcast?
Ooh.
Because I was moving some files around on my computer and I saw how many we had in that folder.
I'm going to guess that we've answered 180 listener questions so far.
Oh, well, you overshot it. So now it feels like the number I'm going to share isn't nearly worthy of praise. But 150. We've answered exactly 150 questions between the Ask episodes on Mondays, as well as some of those questions sprinkled in on Friday episodes.
That was a faux pas on my part. Because I know, like, when my wife's like, guess how much I spent on this? I got to guess under what I even think she might have gotten, because I ruin it if I guess over.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, Wet Blanket Joel. That's going to be your new nickname. But I mean, the reason I mentioned that, though, is because that's a lot of questions, you know, and that's also a lot of answers that we've provided. That's a lot of folks who have maybe trusted our advice. And so we appreciate all of our listeners out there who are listening to our show. And if you've never submitted a question, we would love to hear from you. And hopefully we can take it on an upcoming episode.
Yeah. All right, Matt, we were just talking about micro investing apps. Well, we have a listener here with a question about investing, but specifically doing a Roth conversion. So let's get to that one first.
Hey, Matt and Joel, this is Jonathan in Ohio. Thanks a lot for taking my question today. I'm trying to make some predictions about U.S. tax rates in the year 2060, so I thought, hey, who better to ask than Matt and Joel? So here goes. My wife and I are in our early 30s, and we expect Roth to be our main retirement nest egg, but I have $25,000 from an old traditional 401k that I now have in a Vanguard traditional IRA. And if I use a 9% rate of return as an estimate, this will grow to almost $800,000 by the time I reach 70 and I'm required to take RMDs. So my dilemma is, should I convert this to a Roth now and pay taxes in a 22% tax bracket, or should I wait until we're retired? If we don't have any other ordinary income when we get to retirement, which obviously I don't know is the case, I wonder if we'd be avoiding taxes on it anyway, because that $800,000 is still under $30,000 each year in distributions. Obviously, I know that tax laws will change many times between then and now, but I just wanted to get a second opinion. Thanks.
Well, Jonathan, you know that that's an impossible question to answer.
I love the impossible questions.
Yeah, it's still fun to attempt to predict the unpredictable, though. And a quick note as well, you don't have to take your RMDs, those required minimum distributions, until you are 72 now. That was a result of the SECURE Act, which became law at the end of last year. But honestly, Joel, if you're 70, 72, what difference does 2 years make?
A big difference if you're 70, if you don't have to take the RMD.
But when you're that old, like 2 years, it's just like a blink of an eye. Right? Like the older I get now, like time almost means nothing to me. It goes by so quickly. Makes me think of that picture of you and I from the Face app when we're like, we look like two 70-year-old guys.
It's not going to be that long until we actually get there. Yeah.
That's so true.
No, I understand that. But that is actually a big deal for a lot of people who are trying to plan their retirement withdrawals, and especially as people are living longer, that extra 2 years to not have to take withdrawals is a big deal for people.
Two years of compound growth, especially on that back end like that, is massive.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to discount that, but you know, at the same time, I'm also like, oh, when you're 70, what's 72? That's nothing.
We'll be there before you know it, buddy. All right, well, let's talk about Jonathan's question, Roth conversions. And Jonathan, I think the first thing we need to address is predicting future tax rates. And it's pretty impossible to do that, kind of like Matt said. It's hard to imagine them going lower, though, because if you look at kind of a history of tax rates in this country, we're at a pretty low point, ultimately. And as federal deficits increase and the national debt expands, taxes will likely have to rise to meet our increasing obligations. And Matt, this recent $2 trillion stimulus bill is likely going to cost all of us some money in increased taxes over the coming years. I don't think that the federal government should operate like a household and should have to have like the balanced budget. But at the same time, I do think the increased federal spending, the increased deficit will lead to higher tax rates for us in the coming years. But again, it's impossible to predict. How can I actually know that? It does influence at least a little bit of how we answer this question, though.
Yeah, for sure, man. And so another consideration is where the market is currently, right? Making a Roth conversion in a down market makes a whole lot of sense if you're in a lower tax bracket And in particular, if you do it right now while the market is down. As stock prices have fallen, your tax bill on that conversion is going to be lower than it would have been just a few months ago. It's especially ideal if you can make that conversion in a year in which your income doesn't exceed the marginal 12% tax bracket.
Yeah, basically, the lower your AGI, the lower your taxable income, the more it actually makes sense to do a Roth conversion now.
Yeah, Jonathan, don't wait 10 years when your tax rate's going to be twice as what it is now. That's me predicting the future, which is impossible.
Yeah, that was a bad move, Matt. Don't do that. And I think, too, it's important to note for Jonathan that in order for this to even be on the table, you really have to make sure that you have the cash on hand to pay the tax on the conversion. And at the same time, make sure you aren't depleting your emergency fund in order to make this move. Especially with rampant job insecurity, a contracting economy, it makes sense to hold on to that emergency fund. And if you don't have enough money on hand to keep that intact, as well as paying the tax bill that you're going to incur next year, then don't do it, because that puts you at undue risk. So while we love the idea of making a Roth conversion, you have to be able to pay the taxes that you're going to incur in order to make it a still a smart move.
And Jonathan, another advantage of making that conversion is you have the potential to spread out your tax liability. You didn't really mention this, but if you do happen to have a 401k through maybe a current employer, converting to a Roth with that old money, like, that makes sense to go ahead and do that now, because it's helpful to have both pre-tax and post-tax buckets in retirement. Essentially, you're diversifying your tax liability when the time does come for you to retire.
Yeah, Matt, those different tax buckets, so helpful. Having both pre-tax and post-tax just gives you even more flexibility in retirement to basically dictate what your income is going to look like and dictate what your tax rate's going to be.
Because you don't know what the actual tax rate's going to be in the future.
Yeah, so that's kind of a good way. I think a lot of answers that we give on the show sometimes are split it down the middle. That's a way to split it down the middle.
Yeah.
To have some pre-tax, some post-tax money, you're splitting the difference, and you're giving yourself more flexibility in the future while ensuring some tax breaks now, right? And it really comes down to ultimately us not knowing the future. Like I said at the beginning of your question, Jonathan, we are in a pretty historically low tax environment. I'm kind of keen to take the bird in the hand on this one and make the conversion, especially if most of your retirement account exposure is in those accounts that have already offered you a tax benefit. I would jump at the chance to have some of my money in a post-tax Roth account, because it does add to some of the flexibility you're going to be able to have. Of course, it's hard to know whether you'll actually be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. So just do your best. And either way, keep investing for the long haul. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, these sorts of decisions about whether to convert to a Roth IRA from a traditional IRA, they're good questions to have. But more than anything, growing that nest egg, putting more into it, and making sure you're going to have enough in retirement, that is the bigger part of the equation.
All right, man, we've got a couple more questions that we're going to get to. But first, let's take a quick break.
All right, Matt, we're back from the break. We're going to get to a question about employee stock purchase plans in just a second. But before that, let's get to a question that's on a lot of listeners' minds. Do I pay off debt, or do I invest with the extra money that I've got?
Hi, Joel and Matt. My name is Kate, and I currently live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I love the show, and I found it to be a very valuable, motivational tool for me. I'm coming a bit late to the game. I'm 35. Married with two kids, ages 12 and 4. We're a single income family, and I unfortunately haven't given much thought to my finances until recently. I pretty much let life get carried away, assuming I would take care of things later. So now is later, and I'm working on making sure that I'm in more control of my finances and making better decisions for the future. We have a large amount of debt, including consumer debt, student loans, a personal loan, and a mortgage. I am a teacher and contribute 12% of my income to my 401k annually. Currently, my 401k, though, is it in terms of my savings for the future. I know I need to amp this up, but my debt is absolutely crushing currently, and we're working on a plan to pay it off as soon as possible. But if you have debt, you have no money, and that includes money for savings. But if I only focus on the debt, it will be years before I can begin saving for the future beyond my 401k. My concern is that that would be years of not being able to benefit from compounding interest with investments. So I'm not sure what to do. Focus only on the debt and put off savings until at least most of my debt is taken care of. Or take some amount of money, even if it's small, and begin investing into another retirement account, such as a Roth IRA, while working at the same time to pay off the debt. I would appreciate any advice you may have to help me figure out a solid path going forward. Thank you so much for the help and for all of your work on the podcast. Cheers.
Kate, thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and we are glad that it's been motivational for you. Honestly, though, like, you're not getting started all that late at age 35. Is that what she said?
Yeah, 35 is not that late in the game. I think Kate's giving herself a little bit of a hard time here.
And I think we all understand the realities of, like, pushing something off a little bit further down the road. You know, she was kind of mentioning how she's like, I'm going to save that for later. We've all been there. Like, we don't want to do the harder, difficult things in life, but, you know, you're there now. We understand that you're ready to make some decisions. So that makes me happy, though, that we can kind of guide you along in this stage of life.
And didn't Kate say, too, that her investment rate, her savings rate was 12%? I mean, that's pretty good.
That's solid.
Again, Kate raking herself over the coals when it's unnecessary. Kate, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. I want to say that you didn't mention whether or not you're getting an employer match. If you do, then you should, at a minimum, keep investing up until that match amount, no matter what, when it comes to investing more or paying down debt. For instance, if your employer is putting in 3%, if you put in 6%, if they're essentially matching 50 cents on the dollar, well, then stop at 6% of your money and start funneling that extra money towards your high interest rate debts. Then you're able to, like we were talking about earlier, Matt, kind of splitting the difference. You're doing both simultaneously. And I think that's always a good place to be, especially if you do have high interest rate debts that you want to get rid of.
Yeah. And on that note, we've talked before about the debt snowball and the avalanche. Student loans and mortgages aren't typically the highest priority for us to want to pay off, especially your mortgage. But you should funnel all your extra money towards getting rid of that personal loan ASAP, any of that consumer spending. And then once that is taken care of, you can increase your 401k contribution amount.
Yeah, once you've been able to make good progress on the debt, you can start investing again. But super high interest rate debt does take priority over investing, typically, at least after that match amount.
Yeah, and so tackling that high interest rate debt, like, that's more along the lines of taking the debt avalanche approach, right? Because you're going to start with the higher interest rates. But Kate, because you're already saving within your 401k and you already have a plan to knock out your debt, I think the decision really comes down to taking the route that will be the most effective for motivating you. If the debt snowball appeals to you, then maybe, like, that laser-like focus on purely paying off debt is the way to go. Like, maybe you just want to focus on one item at a time, and then once you've eliminated that completely, then focus on investing. But, you know, if you are going to look at the numbers and take more of a mathematical approach, then that's when the debt avalanche might be for you.
Yeah, Matt, so much of our personal finance lives are emotionally based, and trying to split the difference, which sometimes really does work and it can be the best way to go, it doesn't always work for our mindset. Our brains have such an easier time handling a singular goal. And if that singular goal is going all in and investing as much as we can, or funneling as much money as we can towards high interest rate debts, well, having just one goal makes it so much easier to accomplish. And so if that is what works best for Kate, then I think she should do that. Because, yeah, we like talking about the numbers. We like talking about what makes the most sense and how taking advantage of the match and then putting everything else towards high interest rate debt, that's probably the best way to go. But it's not the best way to go if it's not a plan you can stick to. So whatever it is that Kate can stick to and can continue to feel in control of, that I would say is her best bet.
Nice, man. All right. Our next listener question is about an employee stock purchase plan. Let's hear it.
Hello, guys. My name is Adish. I'm from Philadelphia. I hope you and your families are safe and doing well. Thanks a lot for your podcast and especially for the Friday episodes. They are helping me to keep up with all the COVID-19 related updates. I have a question related to employee share purchase plan. I have enrolled in the ESPP program with my employer, and I was going to sell some of the acquired stocks around February. As market crashed afterwards, I'm holding the stocks right now. I might need the cash in next 1 or 2 years for a real estate investment. So my first question is, should I continue to hold my employer stocks or should I sell them at loss? And my second question is, should I continue to enroll in the ESPP program? Take care and stay safe. Bye.
Adesh, thank you so much for your question. We're doing great. We're staying pretty safe, I think. Right, Matt?
Yeah, man. I only do safe things. I've got kids.
Exactly. We got to make sure we keep our kids away from other people more than even ourselves.
That is true.
Yeah. But hope you're doing well too, Adesh. And this is a great question because ESPPs are awesome if used correctly. And Matt, we went into some detail on ESPPs in particular on episode 156 inside of an Ask HTM episode. But Adesh's question gets into even some more ESPP nuance. So let's get into it.
Yeah, there's so much of your decision to sell and when to sell comes down to like really a couple of things. A, like what you will be doing with that money down the road, and B, the tax consequences of selling it sooner. If you held your ESPP shares for more than 2 years from the offering date and 1 year from your purchase date, it's called a qualifying position, and you're able to report more of your profit as capital gains rather than as earned income. And capital gains tax rates right now are pretty favorable.
Yeah, they are.
So to avoid poor tax treatment, make sure that you reach those thresholds before selling and then make that sale happen at that point. But either way, you don't want to sell those stocks right now, especially at a loss.
Yeah, Matt, so much of the answer comes down to not what the stock is worth right now, but what's the tax treatment? Because that is just as big of a consideration, if not an even bigger consideration to make when you're buying and selling shares. So Adesh, just what Matt said, if you can hit those timetables to give yourself preferred tax treatment, that's going to be a big reason to actually hold on to these shares for now. And we would say too, you asked about continuing to participate in your ESPP. Well, yeah, if you have the money to invest in your ESPP as well as make a meaningful contribution to your 401k and your HSA if you have access to one, and if your employer stock discount is really, really generous, then we would say, yeah, you should totally be participating because it is a major benefit that an employer offers that you should be taking advantage of. Just be sure that the amount of employer stock that you have doesn't exceed 5% of your investment holdings. Investing through your ESPP should be a tiny amount of your overall portfolio. So while it is this awesome perk, you can purchase company stock at a super sweet discount, hold on to it for that minimum time period, sell and get great tax treatment. Well, make sure that you're widely diversified and that most of your investments are in index funds inside of your 401k or an IRA or an HSA, and that this ESPP is just a tiny percentage of the overall investing that you're doing.
Yeah, man. And the reason for that is because of the inherent risk involved with investing in a specific company, single stock investing. It's why we do not recommend that. And on the note of diversification, Adesh, you know, he mentioned his upcoming real estate endeavors as well. Best of luck there. And Joel, speaking of real estate, our next question is about budgeting for a rental property. And so we'll get to that one right after the break.
All right, Matt, we're back from break. We got more listener questions to get to. In just a second, we're going to get to a question about going to medical school. Is that a good idea? But first, let's get to our next question, which is about budgeting to buy a rental property.
Hi there. My name is Hannah. I live in Montana. I know, it's very funny. I was hoping you could give a quick recap about budgeting for a good rental property. I think in that episode, you might have said something like you should set aside the equivalent of 10% of your mortgage for maintenance expenses, another 10% for capital expenses like a roof, and maybe another 10% for vacancy. I had questions about that because it seems like the amount you would then set aside could vary based on the term of your loan. My other question was, when can you stop saving for vacancy? Do you have any advice on that? If we don't anticipate a very high vacancy rate, maybe is there a number of months we should shoot for having saved up? Thanks.
Oh, Matt, it must be tough to live in Montana and have that name at this point in time.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
She brought it up.
It's your nature. Speaking of Miley Cyrus, did you happen to see her performance on SNL at home? You know, they've still been doing SNL, but like an at-home version, the quarantine version.
I haven't watched SNL in like 5 years.
I mean, we're recording this ahead of time, but she did a cover of Wish You Were Here, that Pink Floyd song. That's pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a cool way for them to continue the show, even though they're not really live. So you kind of miss out on some of that audience interaction a little bit, personally.
Yeah,
more like a podcast.
Well, I'm sure Hannah struggled with that throughout the years, depending on how long she's lived in Montana.
Sure.
Which is a wonderful state. But yeah, let's try to offer a couple rules of thumb. And I know it can be overwhelming for new landlords to start to think about the cost they're going to incur when they are buying a rental property. That, not to mention the hassle of buying, renovating, and finding tenants to live in the property that you're buying. That's why a lot of people choose to forgo real estate investing, or at least mom and pop real estate investing. But we're big fans of it because we do think it can have outsized returns over the years. Matt, I think on that episode, we said that 1% of the original purchase price was what you should budget for annual maintenance of a rental property. And I think that's still a pretty helpful number to consider, right? An average $200,000 house will likely incur roughly $2,000 in repairs every single year when averaged out over time. And granted, there's a lot of advice we can share with Hannah on this. But when it comes down to it, so much of the answer when it comes to this question is based in the kind of properties that you're buying, is based in where you're buying, the condition that the property is in. There are so many variables that it's hard to give a precise answer to this question, but we're going to do our best.
Yeah, and Joe, so, you know, like we're getting at here, most beginner real estate investors severely underestimate the cost that it takes to own a rental property. So do take into account the fixed expenses that you'll incur every month, like insurance and trash. Likely some of those expenses are already built into your mortgage payment. But like we said, these costs tend to level out over a longer period of time. But just make sure that you have the cash on hand to be able to make these important repairs from month one. And I'm not sure exactly where you are on your real estate journey, but if you are setting aside 10% for each of those things, you mentioned repairs, you mentioned capital expenses and vacancies, you might even be setting aside too much money. So maybe you're kind of on the other end of the spectrum. However, for most folks, though, that's not the case. Most folks underestimate the amount of money that is going to need to go into the home just to keep it up and running.
Yeah, Matt, and I think in particular with real estate investing, I'm okay with overestimating the cost that you're going to incur, because what happens when you own a property and you have tenants in it and you don't have the money to cover a necessary expense?
You sell it.
And you make it somebody else's problem.
Yeah, I like that.
That's one option. But really, it stinks if you don't have the cash on hand to repair a broken water heater or an HVAC that goes bad in the summer. Those are repairs that you have to make in order to keep your tenant happy and in order to keep the property in good shape. But let's keep talking about rules of thumb, because especially when we're talking about real estate investing, I think other rules of thumb can be helpful. And again, these are rules of thumb because they're good general things to think about. They don't apply to every specific situation, right? But another decent one is that 50% of your rental profits will likely go to repairs on the home. And I think that can be a helpful gauge when you're thinking about how much money to sock away. So the biggest takeaway from that is don't take all the profit that you're taking, all the monthly rent that's above the mortgage, don't take that and spend it. Save a good bit of that, at least 50% of it, for upkeep of the property. Real estate investing is something that you're doing for the long haul, and to continue to attract good tenants and to continue to keep the good tenants that you already have, you really do need to maintain the property well. And so putting that money back into the property for repair costs and upkeep is really crucial throughout the whole process.
And then Hannah, the last bit of your question there had to do with when you can stop saving for vacancy. Once you have that full 10% amount in a savings account for vacancy, you can stop saving for that potential vacancy. Obviously, you don't need to continue to save for that. By the way, you said you don't anticipate a high vacancy rate. Luckily, I've been pretty fortunate to avoid vacancies, but only due to a lot of hard work to get a new tenant in on a short and tight timeline. And additionally, in a contracting economy, it's even more important to plan for some of those potential vacancies and to be maybe a little more conservative with the budget numbers for this property. It's better to be safe than sorry. I think traditionally we would have said that, like, oh, that sounds really conservative just to have your money sitting around like that in cash. But especially given the current crisis that we're in, is there a such thing to have too much cash on hand?
Right.
And I think the answer to that is cash is king. You know, it's important to have enough cash on hand to handle some of these storms, because there are a lot of unforeseen circumstances that we're going to be faced with.
Yeah, Matt, I think if I were to calculate the vacancy rate for all five properties that I own, it's probably something like 2%. It almost never happens. I'm really, really good about getting people in there to do the painting, to do the necessary repairs in between tenants in like a day or two to keep it looking good, to get somebody else in there. But at the same time, when COVID hit, I had a couple of tenants reach out saying they wouldn't be able to pay rent for the month of May. And so no matter how proactive you are, there are certain things that are unforeseen when it comes to being a landlord. So having that vacancy built in to your savings, having money set aside for the times when your property will potentially be unoccupied, is really smart, because even if you're a go-getter, you're proactive, you're making sure that the repairs are done in the right amount of time in order to keep tenants in that property, that still doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be 100% occupied all the time. So Hannah, it sounds like you're asking the right questions. I don't mean to sound too conservative, but I think the more money you can have set aside for potential vacancies and repairs, the better off you'll be and the less stress you'll have as a landlord altogether.
Nice, man. All right, we've got another question. And after this question, we're going to dispense some medical school advice.
Hi, Mandrel. My name is Rick, and I currently live in Ankeny, Iowa. I graduated with my bachelor's last May and have spent the time since then taking a gap year, working in a hospital setting, gaining healthcare experience, and trying to learn how to do this whole adulting thing, which is actually how I ended up finding your guys' podcast. Come August, I will be starting medical school, and I was looking for some advice on how to navigate the financials of this massive life change I will be undergoing, from taking on massive loans to readjusting my budget and whatever else you guys think would be helpful for me to know. I welcome all the advice I can get. Thanks a bunch. Keep giving out great advice and have a wonderful day.
Rick, first, congrats getting into medical school. Also, what a great idea to take a gap year, gain some of that real life experience working in a hospital setting. That makes a whole lot of sense. And I think the first question that we would typically ask, that we typically have for folks about to commit years of additional schooling and the massive costs associated with that learning is, are you sure? Is that what you want to do? Not to dissuade you from something that you're passionate about or something that you really do want to pursue, because if it is something that you've completely got your heart set on, then you should definitely go for it. But it is an important question to ask before you actually do make the decision and start taking on debt because of that decision. But because of your experience working in healthcare this past year, it certainly seems like you shouldn't have any doubts, because if you're still ready to proceed after that, then go ahead, man, make it happen.
Yeah, especially given what we've gone through over the past several months, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much we don't know until we've actually experienced it. And it sounds like Rick is doing that experiencing. So I love that. And Rick, most medical students may not be thinking of scholarships, but there are lots of them available for medical students. There's going to be some specific schools that will offer a full merit scholarship, but then there are going to be groups like the American Medical Association Foundation that has the Physicians of Tomorrow Award, which gives students in their final year of medical school $10,000. There are a lot of traditional resources on the web that you would typically associate with undergrad scholarships, but be sure to check out Scholly, FastWeb, scholarships.com. Like, these are all going to be great sites for you to check out and to see what offerings there are for medical students.
Yeah, pinching your budget is definitely an important thing to do as a college student, but finding scholarships is even better, right? Don't cut your Netflix membership and then not search for scholarships, because that one additional scholarship can have such a huge impact, can massively outweigh just those little cuts that you can make to your budget. But at the same time, right, it is important to think about your budget. Getting an advanced degree is often a lean financial time in people's lives. There's not much money coming in, and you're living in kind of austere quarters typically. And at the same time, you're taking on a good bit of debt, so you're forced to live pretty cheaply. So I would say that the key is to continue to live that way as your pay increases. Right, as someone who is getting a medical degree, once you hit residency, you'll start to see an increased income. And once you start making an even bigger income as a doctor, living like a resident is key to being able to pay off those student debts in as quick a time frame as possible. And Matt, there's a great website out there, The White Coat Investor. Pretty sure his name's Jim Dolly, but he has a site and a podcast. Like, dude is smart, and he has helped so many physicians save money. And his website and his podcast are geared particularly towards people in the medical space. So I think he's got a lot of great advice to offer. I would say that if you're becoming a doctor, if you're in medical school, if you're working towards that, his site and his podcast are great ones to follow, because they're going to be able to help you along the way. But if you can continue to live like a resident all the way through, if you can get those additional scholarships and also cut your costs at the same time, you'll be in a much different place than a lot of people that graduate medical school.
Yeah, we ought to reach out to him and see if we can have him on the show sometime soon.
He'd be a great guest.
Yeah, he would be. Let's kind of back it up too, to actually, you know, you're assuming that we're going to get student loans, but, you know, Rick, we would recommend for you to try to take out as few student loans as you possibly can. If you can bootstrap your way through medical school as much as possible, like, that's, you know, what we would recommend. But when the time does come for you to take out some loans, be sure and start by filling out the FAFSA. It's not just for undergrad, as medical schools do use this to determine how much aid that you're going to be eligible for. And the good news is that your interest rate for your first year loans are going to be much lower, because borrowing rates have gone down a good bit.
Yeah, Matt, that's one silver lining to kind of the difficult times that we're experiencing right now. Lower borrowing rates for students. And another thing I think it's important for Rick to consider is where he's going to work post-graduation. You can get medical school loan forgiveness by taking a number of potential job choices once you're done. For example, the National Health Service Corps offers health providers and professionals the opportunity to receive up to $50,000 in tax relief for loan repayment for a 2-year commitment. Also, medical students in their final year of school can get up to $120,000 in loan repayment for a three-year service commitment at an NHSC site. Also, if you've ever been interested in a military career, there are great benefits for those who choose to serve. So depending on how much student loan debt you have to take on, depending on that overall debt load level, finding the jobs that are going to actually help pay your student loans off, that's a big thing to consider once you're done. And in particular, there are so many needs for doctors rurally across the United States of America. Looking for jobs in rural areas is actually going to be one of the best ways to be able to get relief for some of those student loans. And at the same time, you're probably going to be serving people who need access to good physicians. So it can be rewarding too. So Rick, best of luck to you as you get through medical school. I'm sure it's a long slog. Keep that budget under control, apply for those scholarships, and then make sure you're looking to those bigger opportunities that can pay off once you've actually got your degree in hand. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on the show today. We shared an IPA called Dankbot by Insight Brewing. Big thanks to listener Joe for sending this one our way. What were your thoughts on this beer, man?
Hey, man, this was a solid beer. I'll describe how it poured first, which was a nice golden orange. This is definitely a more of a traditional style IPA because you could see through it. That's how you can tell the difference between the New England style and a more traditional IPA. And I'll mention, too, this one is from Minnesota, and that's where Joe, who sent this one to us, that's where he's from. So I think this must be a local brewery there for him. I hate saying this, but this beer is called Dankbot. I'm going to describe it as dank.
Way to take the easy descriptor.
Yeah, it did have that piney, kind of resiny, earthy flavor to it. Obviously, it had some of the hop edge to it, but at the same time, it was pretty malty as well. So due to that, it did remind me more of maybe some of the more traditional IPAs from yesteryear. But I enjoyed it just as much. It reminded me when you and I first started having beers together, bud. But yeah, man, what were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think the first thing that came to my mind was that it had some abrasively hoppy notes. And I don't mean that negatively. I think abrasive typically is a word that we use to describe things that we don't like. But no, abrasively...
Abrasive personality.
Right, exactly. But abrasively hoppy is good because I like hops. But yeah, it did have some of those old school bitter pine notes. And while piney IPAs aren't typically what you find on store shelves these days, I still really enjoy getting to have one every now and again. And I feel like this was a really good representation of one of the IPAs of yesteryear, I think, as you just put it. So yeah, Dankbot, really, really good beer.
And again, this is a beer by Insight Brewing, sent to us by a friend of the show, Joe, up there in Minnesota. Thanks, Joe. All right, buddy, that's going to be it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll include some of those links to some of those different sites that include all of that scholarship information, whether you're looking at undergrad or education even beyond that.
Yeah, and for anybody who's been listening for a while, we would appreciate a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you have a minute, head over there, hit the 5 stars, and leave a nice little note. We'd really appreciate it.
All right, man. Well, that's going to be it. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.